if it bleeds. In January of 2021, a small padded envelope addressed to Detective Ralph Anderson is delivered to the Conrads, the Andersons' next-door neighbors. The Anderson family is on an extended vacation in the Bahamas, thanks to an endless teacher's strike in the Andersons' home county. Ralph insisted that his son Derek bring his books, which Derek termed a grotesque bummer. The Conrads have agreed to forward their mail until the Andersons return to Flint City, but printed on this envelope, in large letters, is "Do not forward, hold for arrival." When Ralph opens the package, he finds a flash drive titled "If It Bleeds," presumably referring to the old news trope which proclaims, "If it bleeds, it leads." The drive holds two items. One is a folder containing photographs and audio spectrograms. The other is a kind of report, or spoken word diary, from Holly Gibney, with whom the detective shared a case that began in Oklahoma and ended in a Texas cave. It was a case that changed Ralph Anderson's perception of reality forever. The final words of Holly's audio report are from an entry dated December 19th, 2020. She sounds out of breath. "I have done the best I can, Ralph, but it may not be enough. In spite of all my planning, there's a chance I won't come out of this alive. If that's the case, I need you to know how much your friendship has meant to me. If I do die, and you choose to continue what I've started, please be careful. You have a wife and son." This is where the report ends. December 8 through 9, 2020. 1. Pineborough Township is a community not far from Pittsburgh. Although much of western Pennsylvania's farm country, Pineborough boasts a thriving downtown and just shy of 40,000 residents. As you enter the municipal city limits, you pass a gigantic bronze creation of dubious cultural merit, although the residents seem to like it. This is, according to the sign, the world's largest pine cone. There is a turnout for people who want to picnic and take pictures. Many do, some posing their younger children on the cone scales. A small sign reads, "No children over 50 pounds on the pine cone, please." On this day, it's too cold for picnics. The porta-john has been taken away for the season, and the bronze creation of dubious cultural merit is decked out in blinking Christmas lights. Not far beyond the giant cone, close to where the first traffic light marks the beginning of downtown Pineborough, is Albert McCready Middle School, where almost 500 students attend grades 7, 8, and 9. No teacher strike here. At 9:45 on the 8th, a Pinsey Speed delivery truck pulls into the school's circular drive. The delivery guy gets out and stands in front of his truck for a minute or two, consulting his clipboard. Then he pushes his glasses up on the bridge of his narrow nose, gives his little mustache a stroke, and goes around to the back. He rummages and retrieves a square package about 3 feet on all sides. He carries it easily enough, so it can't be too heavy. At the door is an admonishment reading, "All school visitors must be announced and approved." The driver pushes the button on the intercom below the sign, and Mrs. Keller, the school secretary, asks him how she can help. "Got a package here for something called..." He bends to look at the label. "Boy, howdy. It looks like Latin. It's for the Nemo impune... Or maybe you say impune..." Mrs. Keller helps him out. "The Nemo me impune la Cassett Society, right?" On her video monitor, the delivery guy looks relieved. "If you say so. The last word is... society, for sure. What does it mean?"
"Tell you inside."
Mrs. Keller is smiling as the delivery guy walks through the metal detector, enters the main office, and puts the package on the counter. It's plastered with stickers,
a few of Christmas trees and holly and Santas, many more of Scottish guys in kilts and black watch caps honking on bagpipes. "So," he says, taking his reader off his belt and aiming it at the address label, "what's Nemo me impuny when it's home with its shoes off?" "The Scottish national motto," she says. "It means no one provokes me with impunity. Mr. Griswold's current affairs class has a partner's school in Scotland near Edinburgh. They email and Facebook and send pictures to each other and things like that. The Scottish kids root for the Pittsburgh Pirates, our kids for the Bucky Thistle Football Club. The current affairs kids watch the games on YouTube. Calling themselves a Nemo Me Impune Lacessit Society was probably Griswold's idea." She peers at the return address on the label. "Yep, Wren Hill Secondary School, that's the one. Custom stamp and everything." "Christmas presents, I bet," the delivery guy says. "Gotta be, because look here." He tips the box up, showing her Do Not Open Until 18 December, carefully printed and bookended by two more bagpipe-blowing Scots. Mrs. Keller nods. "That's the last day of school before the Christmas break. God, I hope Griswold's kids sent them something."
"What kind of presents do Scottish kids send American kids, do you think?"
She laughs. "I just hope it's not haggis."
"What's that? More Latin?"
"Sheep's heart," Mrs. Keller says. "Also liver and lungs. I know because my husband took me to Scotland for our 10th wedding anniversary." The delivery guy pulls a face that makes her laugh some more, then asks her to sign the window in his reader gadget, which she does. He wishes her a good day and a Merry Christmas. She wishes him the same. When he's gone, Mrs. Keller grabs a loitering kid, no hall pass, but Mrs. Keller lets it go this once, to take the box to the storage closet between the school library and the first floor teacher's room. She tells Mr. Griswold about the package during the lunch break. He says he'll take it down to his classroom at 3:30 after the last bell. Had he taken it at lunch, the carnage might have been even worse. The American Club at Wren Hill Secondary did not send the kids at Albert McCready a Christmas box. There is no such company as Pinsey Speed Delivery. The truck, later discovered abandoned, was stolen from a mall parking lot shortly after Thanksgiving. Mrs. Keller will excoriate herself for not noticing that the delivery guy wasn't wearing a name tag, and when he aimed his reader at the package's address label, it didn't beep the way the ones used by the UPS and FedEx drivers did because it was a fake. So was the custom stamp. The police will tell her anyone might have missed these things, and she has no reason to feel responsible. She does, nevertheless. The school security protocols, the cameras, the main door that's locked when school is in session, the metal detector, are good, but they're only machinery. She is, or was, the human part of the equation, the guardian at the gate, and she let the school down. She let the kids down. Mrs. Keller feels that the arm she lost will only be the beginning of her atonement. 2. It's 2:45, and Holly Gibney is getting ready for an hour that always makes her happy. That may suggest certain low tastes, but she still enjoys her 60 minutes of weekday television viewing and tries to ensure that Finders Keepers, nice new digs for the detective agency, fifth floor of the Frederick Building downtown, is empty from 3 to 4. Since she's the boss, a thing she still finds hard to believe, that isn't difficult. Today, Pete Huntley, her partner in the business since Bill Hodges died, is out trying to track down a runaway at the city's various homeless shelters. Jerome Robinson, taking a year off from Harvard while he tries to turn a 40-page sociology paper into what he hopes will be a book, is also working for Finders Keepers, although only part-time. This afternoon, he's south of the city, looking for a dog-napped golden retriever named Lucky, who may have been dumped at a Youngstown, Akron, or Canton dog impound when Lucky's owners refused to pay the demanded ransom of $10,000. Of course, the dog may just have been turned loose in the Ohio countryside, or killed, but maybe not. The dog's name is a good omen, she told Jerome. She said she was hopeful. You have Holly Hope, Jerome said, grinning. That's right, she replied. Now go on, Jerome, fetch. She's got a good chance of being alone until it's time to close the place up, but it's only the hour between 3 and 4 that she really cares about. With one eye on the clock, she writes a starchy email to Andrew Edwards, a client who was worried that his partner was trying to hide business assets. Turns out the partner wasn't, but Finders did the work and needs to be paid. This is our third billing, Holly writes. Please clear your account so we don't have to turn this matter over to a collection agency. Holly finds she can be much more forceful when she can write our and we rather than my and I. She's working on that, but as her grandfather was wont to say, Rome wasn't built in a day, and neither was Philadelphia. She sends off the email, whoosh, and shuts down her computer. She glances at the clock, 7 to 3. She goes to the little fridge and takes out a can of Diet Pepsi. She puts it on one of the coasters the firm gives out. You lose, we find, you win. Then opens the top left drawer of her desk. And here, concealed by a pile of junk paperwork, is a bag of Snickers bites. She takes out 6, one for each commercial break during her show, unwraps them, and lines them up. 5 to 3. She turns on the television but mutes it. Maury Povich is currently strutting around and inciting his studio audience. She may have low taste, but not that low. She considers eating one of her Snickers and tells herself to wait. Just as she is congratulating herself on her forbearance, she hears the elevator and rolls her eyes. It must be Pete. Jerome is way down south. It's Pete, all right, and smiling. Oh, happy day, he says. Somebody finally got Al to send a repairman. Al did nothing, Holly said. Jerome and I took care of it. It was just a glitch. How? There was a small hack involved. She still got one eye on the clock. 3 minutes to 3. Jerome did that, but I could have. Once more, honesty compels her. At least, I think so. Did you find the girl? Pete gives her 2 thumbs up.
At Sunrise House, my first stop. Good news. She wants to go home. She called her mom, who's coming to get her.
Are you sure? Or is that what she told you?
I was there when she made the call. I saw the tears. This is a good resolution, Holly. I just hope Mom's not a deadbeat like that guy Edwards.
Edwards will pay, she says. My heart is set on it.
On the TV, Maury has been replaced by a dancing bottle of diarrhea medicine, which in Holly's opinion is actually an improvement.
Now, be quiet, Pete. My show is coming on in 1 minute.
Oh, my God, are you still watching that guy?
Holly gives him a forbidding look.
You are welcome to watch, Pete, but if you intend to make sarcastic remarks and spoil my enjoyment, I wish you would leave.
Be assertive, Allie Winters likes to tell her. Allie is her therapist. Holly saw another therapist briefly, a man who has written 3 books and many scholarly articles. This was for reasons apart from the demons that have chased her out of her teens. She needed to talk about more recent demons with Dr. Carl Morton.
No sarcastic remarks, Roger that, Pete says. Man, I can't believe you and Jerome bypassed Al, took the bull by the horns, so to speak. You rock, Holly.
I'm trying to be more assertive.
And you're succeeding. Is there Coke in the fridge?
Only diet.
Ugh, that stuff tastes like... Hush!
It's 3 o'clock. She unmutes the TV just as her show's theme song starts up. It's the Bobby Fuller Four singing, I Fought the Law. A courtroom comes on the screen. The spectators, actually a studio audience like Maury's but less feral, are clapping along with the music and the announcer intones,
Steer clear if you're a louse, because John Law is in the house.
All rise, George the bailiff cries. The spectators get up still clapping and swaying as Judge John Law comes out of his chambers.
He's 6'6", Holly knows this from People magazine, which she hides even better than her Snickers bites, and bald as an 8-ball, although he's more dark chocolate than black. He's wearing voluminous robes that sway back and forth as he boogies his way to the bench. He grabs the gavel and tick-tocks it back and forth like a metronome, flashing a full deck of white teeth. "Oh, my dear Jesus, in a motorized wheelchair," Pete says. Holly gives him her most forbidding look. Pete claps one hand over his mouth and waves the other one in surrender.
"Sit down, sit down,"
says Judge Law. Actual name Gerald Lawson, Holly also knows this from People, but it's close enough. And the spectators all sit down. Holly likes John Law because he's straight from the shoulder, not all snarky and poopy like that Judge Judy. He gets to the point, just as Bill Hodges used to. Although Judge John Law is no substitute, and not just because he's a fictional character on a TV show. It's been years since Bill passed away, but Holly still misses him. Everything she is, everything she has, she owes to Bill. There's no one like him. Although Ralph Anderson, her police detective friend from Oklahoma, comes close.
"What have we got today, Georgie, my brother from another mother?"
The spectators chortle at this.
"Civil or criminal?"
Holly knows it's unlikely the same judge would handle both kinds of cases, and a new one every afternoon, but she doesn't mind. The cases are always interesting.
"Civil, Judge," Georgie the bailiff says. "The plaintiff is Mrs. Rhoda Daniels. The defendant is her ex-husband, Richard Daniels. At issue is custody of the family dog, Bad Boy."
"A dog case," Pete says, "right up our alley." Judge Law leans on his gavel, which is extra long.
"And is Bad Boy in the house, Georgie, my man?" "He is in a holding room, Judge." "Very good, very good. And does Bad Boy bite, as his name might indicate?"
"According to security, he seems to have a very sweet nature, Judge Law."
"Excellent. Let's hear what the plaintiff has to say about Bad Boy."
At this point, the actor playing Rhoda Daniels enters the courtroom. In real life, Holly knows the plaintiff and defendant would already be seated, but this is more dramatic. As Miss Daniels sways down the center aisle in a dress that's too tight and heels that are too high, the announcer says, "We'll return to Judge Law's courtroom in just a minute." An ad for death insurance comes on, and Holly pops her first Snickers bite into her mouth.
"Don't suppose I could have one of those, could I?" Pete asks.
"Aren't you supposed to be on a diet?"
"I get low sugar at this time of day."
Holly opens her desk drawer reluctantly, but before she can get to the candy bag, the old lady worrying about how she can pay her husband's funeral expenses is replaced by a graphic that says, "Breaking news." This is followed by Lester Holt, and Holly knows right away it's going to be serious. Lester Holt is the network's big gun. "Not another 9/11, she thinks every time something like this happens. "Please God, not another 9/11 and not nuclear."
Lester says, "We're interrupting your regularly scheduled programming to bring you news of a large explosion at a middle school in Pineboro, Pennsylvania, a town about 40 miles southeast of Pittsburgh. There are reports of numerous casualties, many of them children."
"Oh, my God," Holly says. She puts the hand that was in the drawer over her mouth.
"These reports are so far unconfirmed, I want to emphasize that. I think..."
Lester puts a hand to his ear, listens.
"Yes, okay. Chet Ondowski from our Pittsburgh affiliate is on the scene. Chet, can you hear me?"
"Yes," a voice says. "Yes, I can, Lester."
"What can you tell us, Chet?"
The picture switches away from Lester Holt to a middle-aged guy with what Holly thinks of as a local news face. Not handsome enough to be a major market anchor, but presentable. Except the knot of his tie is crooked. There's no makeup to cover the mole beside his mouth, and his hair is mussy as if he didn't have time to comb it.
"What's that he's standing beside?" Pete asks.
"I don't know," Holly says. "Hush!"
"Looks like sort of a giant pine cone."
"Hush!" Holly could care less about the giant pine cone or Chet Ondowski's mole and mussed-up hair. Her attention is fixed on the two ambulances that go screaming past behind him, nose to tail with their lights flashing. "Casualties," she thinks. "Numerous casualties. Many of them children."
"Lester,"
What I can tell you is that there are almost certainly at least 17 dead here at Albert MacCready Middle School and many more injured. This comes from a county sheriff's deputy who asked not to be identified by name. The explosive device may have been in the main office or a nearby storage room. If you look over there...
He points, and the camera obediently follows his finger. At first, the picture is blurry, but when the cameraman steadies and zooms, Holly can see a large hole has been blown in the side of the building. Bricks scatter across the lawn in a corona. And as she's taking this in, with millions of others probably, a man in a yellow vest emerges from the hole with something in his arms. A small something wearing sneakers. No, one sneaker. The other has apparently been torn off in the blast. The camera returns to the correspondent and catches him straightening his tie.
The sheriff's department will undoubtedly be holding a press conference at some point, but right now informing the public is the least of their concerns. Parents have already started to gather. Ma'am, can I speak to you for just a moment? Chet Ondowski, WPEN, Channel 11.
The woman who comes into the shot is vastly overweight. She has arrived at the school without a coat, and her flower print house dress billows around her like a caftan. Her face is dead pale except for bright spots of red on her cheeks. Her hair is disarrayed enough to make Ondowski's mussy-do look neat. Her plump cheeks glisten with tears. They shouldn't be showing this, Holly thinks, and I shouldn't be watching it. But they are, and I am.
Ma'am, do you have a child who attends Albert MacCready?
My son and daughter both do, she says, and grabs Ondowski's arm. Are they okay?
Do you know that, sir? Irene and David Vernon. David's in the 7th grade, Irene's in the 9th. We call Irene Deeney. Do you know if they are okay?
I don't, Mrs. Vernon, Ondowski says. I think you should talk to one of the deputies over where they're setting up those sawhorses.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Pray for my kids.
I will, Ondowski says as she rushes off a woman who will be very lucky to survive the day without having some sort of cardiac episode.
Although Holly guesses that right now her heart is the least of her concerns. Right now her heart is with David and Irene, also known as Deeney.
Ondowski turns back to the camera.
Everyone in America will be praying for the Vernon children and all the children who were attending Albert MacCready Middle School today. According to the information I have now, it's sketchy and this could change. The explosion occurred at about 2:15, an hour ago, and was strong enough to shatter windows a mile away. The glass. Fred, can you get a shot of this pine cone?
There, I knew it was a pine cone, Pete says. He's leaning forward, eyes glued to the television. Fred, the camera guy, moves in, and on the pine cone's petals, or leaves, or whatever you call them, Holly can see shards of broken glass. One actually appears to have blood on it, although she can hope it's just a passing reflection cast by the lights on one of the ambulances. Lester Holt.
Chet, that's horrible. Just awful.
The camera pulls back and returns to Ondowski.
Yes, it is. This is a horrible scene. Lester, I want to see if...
A helicopter with a Red Cross and Mercy Hospital stenciled on the side is landing in the street. Chet Ondowski's hair swirls in the wash of the rotors and he raises his voice to be heard.
I want to see if I can do anything to help. This is terrible. Just a terrible tragedy. Back to you in New York.
Lester Holt returns looking upset.
Be safe, Chet. Folks, we're going to return you to your regularly scheduled programming, but we'll continue to update you on this developing situation at NBC Breaking News on your...
Holly uses the remote and kills the TV. She has lost her taste for make-believe justice, at least for today. She keeps thinking of that limp form in the arms of the man wearing the yellow vest. One shoe off, one shoe on, she thinks. Deedle-deedle-dumply, my son John. Will she watch the news tonight? She supposes she will. Won't want to, but won't be able to help herself. She'll have to know how many casualties and how many are children. Pete surprises her by taking her hand. Usually she still doesn't like to be touched, but right now his hand feels good holding hers. I want you to remember something, he says. She turns to him. Pete is grave.
You and Bill stopped something much worse than this from happening, he says. That crackpot fuck Brady Hartsfield could have killed hundreds at the rock concert he tried to blow up, maybe thousands.
And Jerome, she says in a low voice. Jerome was there too.
Yep. You, Bill, and Jerome. The three musketeers. That you could stop and did. But stopping this one, Pete nods to the TV. That was someone else's responsibility.
3. At 7 o'clock, Holly is still in the office going over invoices that don't really need her attention. She managed to resist turning on the office TV and watching Lester Holt at 6:30, but she doesn't want to go home just yet. That morning she had been looking forward to a nice veggie dinner from Mr. Chow, which she would eat while watching Pretty Poison, a vastly overlooked thriller from 1968 starring Anthony Perkins and Tuesday Weld, but tonight she doesn't want poison, pretty or otherwise. She has been poisoned by the news from Pennsylvania, and still might not be able to resist turning on CNN. That would gift her with hours of tossing and turning until 2 or even 3 in the morning. Like most people in the media-soaked 21st century, Holly has become inured to the violence men, it's still mostly men, do to each other in the name of religion or politics. Those ghosts. But what happened at that suburban middle school is too much like what almost happened at the Midwest Culture and Arts Complex, where Brady Hartsfield tried to blow up a few thousand kids, and what did happen at City Center, where he plowed a Mercedes sedan into a crowd of job seekers, killing, she doesn't remember how many. She doesn't want to remember. She is putting away the files. She has to go home sometime, after all, when she hears the elevator again. She waits to see if it will go past the 5th floor, but it stops. Probably Jerome, but she still opens the 2nd drawer of her desk and loosely grips the can there. It has 2 buttons. One blares an ear-splitting horn, the other dispenses pepper spray. It's him. She lets go of the intruder guard and closes the drawer. She marvels, and not for the first time since he came back from Harvard, at how tall and handsome he's become. She dislikes that fur around his mouth, what he calls the goat, but would never tell him so. Tonight, his usual energetic walk is slow and a little slumped. He gives her a perfunctory, "Yo, Holly Berry," and drops into the chair that in business hours is reserved for clients. Usually she would admonish him about how much she dislikes that childish nickname. It's their form of call and response. But not tonight. They are friends, and because she's a person who has never had many, Holly tries her best to deserve the one she has. "You look very tired."
"Long drive. Heard the news about school. It's all over the sat radio."
"I was watching John Law when they broke in. Since then, I've been avoiding it. How bad?"
"They're saying 27 dead so far, 23 of them kids between 12 and 14. But it'll go higher. There are still a few kids and 2 teachers they haven't been able to account for, a dozen or so in critical condition. It's worse than Parkland. Make you think of Brady Hartsfield?"
"Of course."
"Yeah, me too. The ones he got at City Center and the ones he could have gotten if we'd been just a few minutes slower that night at the Round Here concert. I try not to think about that. Tell myself we won that one, because when my mind goes to it, I get the willies."
Holly knows all about the willies. She has them often.
Jerome rubs a hand slowly down one cheek, and in the quiet she can hear the scritch-scritch of his fingers on the day's new bristles. "Sophomore year at Harvard, I took a philosophy course. Did I ever mention that to you?" Holly shakes her head. "It was called," Jerome makes finger quotes, "The Problem of Evil. In it, we talked a lot about concepts called inside evil and outside evil. Holly, you okay?"
"Yes," she says, and she is. But at the mention of outside evil,
Her mind immediately turns to the monster she and Ralph tracked to his final lair. The monster had gone under many names and worn many faces, but she had always thought of him simply as the outsider. And the outsider had been as evil as they come. She's never told Jerome about what happened in the cave known as the Marysville Hole, although she supposes he knows something pretty dire went on there, a lot more than made it into the newspapers. He's looking at her uncertainly. "Go on," she tells him. "This is very interesting to me. It's the truth."
"Well, the class consensus was there's outside evil, if you believe in outside good."
"God," Holly says.
"Yes, then you can believe there really are demons, and exorcism is a valid response to them. There really are malevolent spirits."
"Ghosts," Holly says.
"Right. Not to mention curses that really work, and witches, and Dybbuk's, and who knows what else. But in college, all that stuff pretty much gets laughed out of court. God himself mostly gets laughed out of court."
"Or herself," Holly says primly.
"Yeah, whatever. If God doesn't exist, I guess the pronouns don't matter. So that leaves inside evil. Moron stuff. Guys who beat their children to death. Serial killers like Brady fucking Hartsfield. Ethnic cleansing. Genocide. 9/11. Mass shootings. Terrorist attacks like the one today."
"Is that what they're saying?" Holly asks. "A terrorist attack? Maybe ISIS?"
"That's what they're assuming. But no one's claimed responsibility yet."
Now his other hand on his other cheek. Scritch, scritch. And are those tears in Jerome's eyes? She thinks they are. And if he cries, she will too. She won't be able to help it. Sadness is catching. And how poopy is that?
"But see, here's the deal about inside and outside evil, Holly.
I don't think there's any difference. Do you?" She considers everything she knows and everything she's been through with this young man and Bill and Ralph Anderson.
"No," she says, "I don't."
"I think it's a bird," Jerome says. "A big bird, all frowsy and frosty gray. It flies here, there, and everywhere. It flew into Brady Hartsfield's head. And flew into the head of the guy who shot all those people in Las Vegas. Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold. They got the bird. Hitler. Pol Pot. It flies into their heads, and when the wet work's done, it flies away again. I'd like to catch that bird." He clenches his hands and looks at her, and yes, those are tears. "Catch it and wring its fucking neck." Holly comes around the desk, kneels beside him, and puts her arms around him. It's a clumsy hug with him sitting in the chair, but it does the job. The dam breaks. When he speaks against her cheek, she feels the scratch of his stubble.
"The dog's dead."
"What?" She can barely make out what he's saying through his sobs.
"Lucky. The golden. When whoever stole him didn't get the ransom, the bastard cut him open and threw him in a ditch. Somebody spotted him, still alive, barely, and took him to the Ebert Animal Hospital in Youngstown, where he lived for maybe half an hour, nothing they could do. Not so lucky, after all, huh?"
"All right," Holly says, patting his back. Her own tears are flowing, and her snot, too. She can feel it running out of her nose.
"Oof.
All right, Jerome, it's okay."
"It's not. You know it's not."
He pulls back and looks at her cheeks wet and shining, goatee damp.
"Cut that nice dog's belly open and threw him in a ditch with his intestines hanging out. And you know what happened then?"
Holly knows, but shakes her head.
"The bird flew away."
He wipes his sleeve across his eyes. "Now it's in someone else's head. It's better than ever. And on we fucking go."
4. Just before 10 o'clock, Holly gives up the book she's trying to read and turns on the TV.
She takes a look at the talking heads on CNN but can't bear their chatter. Hard news is what she wants. She switches to NBC where a graphic complete with grim music reads, Special Report, Tragedy in Pennsylvania. Andrea Mitchell is now anchoring in New York. She begins by telling America that the president has tweeted his thoughts and prayers as he does after each of these horror shows. Pulse, Las Vegas, Parkland. This meaningless twaddle is followed by the updated score. 31 dead. 73. Oh God, so many. Wounded. 9 in critical condition. If Jerome was right, that means at least 3 of the criticals have died. 2 terrorist organizations, Houthi Jihad and the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, have claimed responsibility for the bombing, Mitchell says. But sources in the State Department say neither claim is credible. They are leaning toward the idea that the bombing may have been a lone wolf attack, similar to that perpetrated by Timothy McVeigh, who set off a huge blast at the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City in 1995. That explosion took 168 lives. Many of those also children, Holly thinks. Killing children for God, or ideology, or both. No hell could be hot enough for those who do such things. She thinks of Jerome's frosty gray bird. The man who delivered the bomb was photographed by a security camera when he buzzed for entry, Mitchell continues. We are going to put his picture up for the next 30 seconds. Look closely, and if you recognize him, call the number on your screen. There is a reward of $200,000 for his arrest and subsequent conviction. The picture comes up. It's color and clear as a bell. It's not perfect because the camera is positioned above the door and the man is looking straight ahead, but it's pretty good. Holly leans forward, all her formidable job skills, some that were always innate, some honed during her work with Bill Hodges, kicking in. The guy is either Caucasian with a tan, not likely at this time of year but not impossible, a light-skinned Latino, a Middle Easterner, or possibly wearing makeup. Holly opts for Caucasian and makeup. She puts his age as mid-40s. He's wearing specs with gold frames. His black mustache is small and neatly trimmed. His hair, also black, is short. She can see this because he's not wearing a cap, which would have obscured more of his face. Bold son of a gun, Holly thinks. He knew there would be cameras. He knew there would be pictures. And he didn't care. Not a son of a gun, she says, still staring, recording every feature. Not because this is her case, but because it's her nature. He's a son of a bitch, is what he is. Back to Andrea Mitchell. If you know him, call the number on the screen and do it right away. Now we're going to take you to the McCready Middle School and our man on the scene. Chet, are you still there? He is standing in a pool of bright light thrown by the camera. More bright lights are shining on the middle school's wounded side. Each tumbled brick casts its own sharp shadow. Generators are roaring. People in uniform rush here and there, shouting and talking into mics. Holly sees FBI on some of the jackets, ATF on others. There's a crew in white Tyvek bodysuits. Yellow crime scene tape flutters. There's a sense of controlled chaos. At least Holly hopes it's controlled. Someone must be in charge. Maybe in the Winnebago she can see at the far left of the shot. Lester Holt is presumably at home, watching this in his PJs and slippers, but Chet Ondowski is still going. A regular Energizer bunny is Mr. Ondowski, and Holly can understand that. This is probably the biggest story he'll ever cover. He was in on it almost from the start, and he's chasing it for all he's worth. He's still wearing his suit jacket, which was probably okay when he got to the site, but now the temperature has dropped. She can see his breath, and she's pretty sure he's shivering. Someone give him something warmer, for heaven's sake, Holly thinks. A parka, or even a sweatshirt. The suit jacket will have to be thrown out. It's smeared with brick dust and torn in a couple of places, sleeve and pocket. The hand holding the mic is also smeared with brick dust and something else. Blood. Holly thinks it is. And the streak on his cheek, that's blood too.
Chet, Andrea Mitchell's disembodied voice. Are you there?
The hand not holding the mic goes to his earpiece, and Holly sees there are band-aids on two of the fingers.
Yes, I'm here.
He faces the camera.
This is Chet Ondowski reporting from the bombing site at Albert McCready Middle School in Pineboro, Pennsylvania. This ordinarily peaceful school was rocked by an explosion of enormous strength sometime not long after 2 o'clock this afternoon.
Andrea Mitchell appears on a split screen. Chet, we understand from a source at Homeland Security that the explosion happened at 2:19 p.m. I don't know how the authorities can pinpoint the time that exactly, but apparently they can.
Yes,
Chet says, sounding a little distracted. Holly thinks how tired he must be. And will he be able to sleep tonight? She guesses not.
Yes, that sounds just about right. As you can see, Andrea, the search for victims is winding down, but the forensic work is just beginning. There will be more personnel on the scene by daybreak, and...
Excuse me, Chet, but you took part in the search yourself, is that right?
Yes, Andrea. We all pitched in. Townspeople, some of them parents. Also, Allison Greer and Tim Wichick from KDKA, Donna Forbes from WPCW, and Bill Larson from...
Yes, but I'm hearing you pulled two children from the ruins yourself, Chet. He doesn't bother looking falsely modest and aw shucks. Holly awards him points for that. He keeps it on a reporting level.
That's correct, Andrea. I heard one of them moaning and saw the other, a girl and a boy. I know the boy's name, Norman Fredericks. The girl...
He wets his lips. The mic in his hand trembles, and Holly thinks not just from the cold.
The girl was in bad shape. She was calling for her mother.
Andrea Mitchell looks stricken. Chet, that's awful. It is. Too awful for Holly. She picks up the remote to kill the feed. She has the salient facts, more than she has any use for. And then hesitates. It's the torn pocket she's looking at. Maybe torn while Ondowski was searching for victims. But if he's Jewish, it might have been done on purpose. It might have been karia, the rending of garments after a death and the symbolic exposure of a wounded heart. She guesses that is the truth of that torn pocket. It is what she wants to believe. 5. The sleeplessness she expected doesn't happen. Holly drops off within a matter of minutes. Perhaps crying with Jerome let out some of the poison the news from Pennsylvania had injected in her, giving comfort and receiving it. As she slips away, she thinks she should talk about that with Allie Winters at their next session. She wakes sometime deep in the early hours of December 9th, thinking about the correspondent, Ondowski. Something about him. What? How tired he looked? The scratches and brick dust on his hands? The torn pocket? That, she thinks, it must have been. Maybe I was dreaming about it. She mutters briefly into the dark, a kind of prayer. I miss you, Bill. I'm taking my Lexapro, and I'm not smoking. Then she's out and doesn't wake up until the alarm goes at 6 a.m. December 9 through 13, 2020. 1. Finders Keepers has been able to move to the new pricier digs on the 5th floor of the Frederick Building downtown because business has been good, and the rest of that week is busy for Holly and Pete. There's no time for Holly to watch John Law and... Little to think about the school explosion in Pennsylvania, though the news reports continue and it never completely leaves her mind. The agency has working relationships with two of the city's big law firms, the white shoe kind with lots of names on the door. McIntosh, Winesap, and Spy, Pete likes to joke. As retired police, he has no great love for lawyers, but he would be the second to admit, Holly would be the first, that subpoenas and process serving pay very well. Merry fucking Christmas to these guys, Pete says as he goes out on Thursday morning with a briefcase full of woe and annoyance.
In addition to serving papers, Finders Keepers is on speed dial at several insurance companies, locals, not affiliated with the big boys, and Holly spends most of Friday investigating an arson claim. It's a pretty big one. The policyholder really needs the money, and she has been tasked with making sure that he was actually in Miami as he claimed when his warehouse went up in flames. Turns out he was, which is good for him, but not so good for Lake Fidelity. In addition to those things, which reliably pay the big bills, there's an absconding debtor to track. Holly does this on her computer and locates him quickly by checking his credit charges. Bail jumpers to put on the radar, what's known in the trade as skip tracing, and lost kids and dogs. Pete usually goes after the kids, and when Jerome's working, he's great with the dogs. She's not surprised that Lucky's death hit him so hard, not just because it was so extraordinarily cruel, but because the Robinson family lost their beloved Odell to congestive heart failure the year before. There are no dogs on the docket, either lost or abducted, on that Thursday and Friday, which is good, because Holly is too busy and Jerome is at home doing his own thing. The project that started as a school paper has now become a priority with him, if not an outright obsession. His folks are doubtful about their son's decision to take what he calls a gap year. Holly isn't. She doesn't necessarily think Jerome is going to shock the world, but she has an idea he will make it sit up and take notice. She has faith in him, and Holly hope that too. She can only follow developments on the middle school explosion out of the corner of her eye, and that's okay, because there haven't been many. Another victim has died, a teacher, not a student, and a number of kids with minor injuries have been released from various area hospitals. Mrs. Althea Keller, the only person who actually spoke to the delivery guy bomber, has regained consciousness, but she had little to add other than the fact that the package purported to be from a school in Scotland, and that cross-Atlantic relationship was in Pineborough's weekly newspaper, along with a group photo of the Nemo Me Impune Lacessit Society. Perhaps ironic, but probably not, all 11 of the Impunes, as they call themselves, survived the explosion uninjured. The van was found in a nearby barn, wiped clean of prints and bleach cleaned of DNA. The police have been inundated with calls from people eager to identify the perp, but none of the calls has produced results. Hopes of an early capture are being replaced by fears that the guy may not be done, but only getting started. Holly hopes this isn't so, but her experience with Brady Hartsfield makes her fear the worst. Best case scenario, she thinks, with a coldness that once would have been alien to her, he's killed himself. On Friday afternoon, as she's finishing her report to Lake Fidelity, the phone rings. It's her mother, and with news Holly has been dreading. She listens, she says the appropriate things, and she allows her mother to treat her as the child she thinks Holly still is, even though the purpose of this call will involve Holly acting like a grown-up, asking if Holly is remembering to brush after every meal, if she is remembering to take her medication with food, if she is limiting her movies to 4 a week, etc., etc. Holly tries to ignore the headache her mother's calls, and this call in particular, almost always bring on. She assures her mother that yes, she will be there on Sunday to help, and yes, she will be there by noon, so they can eat one more meal as a family. My family, Holly thinks. My fracked-up family. Because Jerome keeps his phone off when he's working, she calls Tanya Robinson, Jerome and Barbara's mom. Holly tells Tanya she won't be able to eat Sunday dinner with them because she needs to go upstate. Kind of a family emergency, she explains, and Tanya says, "Oh, Holly, I'm so sorry to hear that, sweetie. Are you going to be all right?" "Yes," Holly says. It's what she always says when someone asks her that horrible, loaded question. She's pretty sure she sounds okay, but as soon as she hangs up, she puts her hands over her face and begins to cry. It's that sweetie that does it. To have someone call her, who was known in high school as Jibba Jibba, sweetie. To have that, at least, to come back to. 2. On Saturday night, Holly plans her drive using the Waze app on her computer, factoring in a stop to pee and gas up her Prius. To get there by noon, she will have to leave at 7:30, which will give her time for a cup of tea, decaf, toast, and a boiled egg. With this groundwork laid to a nicety, she lies awake for 2 hours as she didn't on the night after the MacReady school blew up, and when she does sleep, she dreams of Chet Undowski. He is telling about the carnage he saw when he joined the first responders and saying things he would never say on television. "There was blood on the bricks," he says. "There was a shoe with a foot still in it," he says. "The little girl who cried for her mommy," he says, "screamed in pain, even though he tried to be gentle when he took her in his arms." He tells these things in his best just the facts voice, but as he talks, he rends his clothes. Not just his suit coat pocket and sleeve, but first one lapel and then the other. He yanks off his tie and rips it in two, then the shirt right down the front, popping off the buttons. The dream either fades before he can go to work on the trousers of his suit, or her conscious mind refuses to remember it the next morning when her phone alarm goes off. In any case, she wakes feeling unrested, and she eats her egg and toast with no pleasure, just fueling up for what will be a trying day. She usually enjoys a road trip, but the prospect of this one sits on her shoulders like a physical weight. Her little blue bag, what she thinks of as her notions bag, is by the door, packed with a clean change of clothes and her toiletries, in case she has to spend the night. She slides the strap onto her shoulder, takes the elevator down from her cozy little apartment, opens the door, and there is Jerome Robinson sitting on the front step. He's drinking a Coke, and his backpack with its Jerry Garcia Lives sticker is resting beside him. "Jerome, what are you doing here?" And because she can't help it, "and drinking Coke at 7:30 in the morning."
"Oof."
"I'm going with you," he says, and the look he gives her says that arguing will do no good. That's okay, because she doesn't want to. "Thanks, Jerome," Holly says. It's hard, but she manages not to cry. "That's very good of you." 3. Jerome drives the first half of the journey, and at the gas and pee stop on the turnpike, they switch. Holly feels her sense of dread at what's awaiting her. "Us," she corrects herself, starting to close in as they get closer to the Cleveland suburb of Covington. To keep it at bay, she asks Jerome how his project is going, his book. "Of course, if you don't want to talk about it, I know some authors don't." But Jerome is willing enough. It began as a required assignment for a class called Sociology in Black and White. Jerome decided to write about his great-great-grandfather, born of former slaves in 1878. Alton Robinson spent his childhood and early adulthood in Memphis, where a thriving black middle class existed in the latter years of the 19th century. When yellow fever and white vigilante gangs struck at that nicely balanced sub-economy, much of the black community simply pulled up stakes, leaving the white folks they'd worked for to cook their own food, dispose of their own garbage, and wipe their own babies' beshitted bottoms. Alton settled in Chicago, where he worked in a meatpacking plant, saved his money, and opened a juke joint 2 years before Prohibition. Rather than close down when the biddies started busting the barrels, this from a letter Alton wrote to his sister, Jerome has found a trove of letters and documents in storage, he changed locations and opened a Southside speakeasy that became known as the Black Owl. The more Jerome discovered about Alton Robinson, his dealings with Alphonse Capone, his 3 escapes from assassination, the 4th did not go so well, his probable sideline in blackmail, his political king-making, the more his paper grew, and the more his work for other classes seemed insignificant in comparison. He turned the long essay in and received a laudatory grade. "Which was sort of a joke," he tells Holly as they roll into the last 50 miles of their journey. "That paper was just, you know, the tip of the iceberg, or like the first verse in one of those endless English ballads. But by then I was halfway through spring semester and I had to pick up the slack in my other courses. Make the mater and pater proud, you know."
That was very adult of you, says the woman who feels she never succeeded in making her mother and late father proud. But it must have been hard.
It was hard, Jerome says. I was on fire, kiddo. Wanted to drop everything else and chase great-great-grandpa Alton. That man had a fabulous life. Diamonds and pearl stick pins and a mink coat. But letting it age a little was the right thing to do. When I went back to it, this was last June, I saw how it had a theme, or could have if I did the job right. Have you ever read The Godfather?
Read the book, saw the movie, Holly says promptly. All three movies, she feels compelled to add. The last one isn't very good.
Do you remember the epigraph of the novel?
She shakes her head.
It's from Balzac. Behind every great fortune, there is a crime. That was the theme I saw, even though the fortune ran through his fingers long before he was shot down in Cicero.
It really is like The Godfather, Holly marvels, but Jerome shakes his head.
It's not, because black people can never be American in the same way Italian and Irish people can. Black skin withstands the melting pot. I want to say, he pauses, I want to say that discrimination is the father of crime. I want to say that Alton Robinson's tragedy was that he thought that through crime he could achieve some sort of equality, and that turned out to be a chimera. In the end, he wasn't killed because he got crossways with Paulie Rica, who was Capone's successor, but because he was black, because he was a nigger. Jerome, who used to irritate Bill Hodges and scandalize Holly by sometimes doing a minstrel show colored accent, "Oh, yes, sir, boss, and I shall do, sir," spits this last word.
Do you have a title? Holly asks quietly. They are nearing the Covington exit.
I think so, yeah. But I didn't think it up. Jerome looks embarrassed.
Listen, Holly Berry, if I tell you something, do you promise to keep it secret? From Pete and from Barb and my parents, especially them?
Of course, I can keep a secret.
Jerome knows this is true, but still hesitates for a moment before plunging.
My prof in that black-and-white sociology class sent my paper to an agent in New York. Elizabeth Austin is her name. She was interested, so after Thanksgiving I sent her the 100 or so pages I've written since summer. Miss Austin thinks it's publishable, and not just by an academic press, which was about as high as I was shooting. She thinks one of the majors might be interested. She suggested calling it by the name of Great-Great-Gramp Speakeasy. Black Owl, the Rise and Fall of an American Gangster.
Jerome, that's wonderful. I bet tons of people would be interested in a book with a title like that.
Black people, you mean?
No, all kinds. Do you think only white people liked The Godfather?
Then a thought strikes her.
Only, how would your family feel about it?
She's thinking of her own family, which would be horrified to have such a skeleton dragged out of the closet.
Well, Jerome says, they both read the paper and loved it.
Of course, that's different from a book, isn't it? One that might be read by a lot more people than a teacher. But it's four generations back, after all.
Jerome sounds troubled. She sees him look at her, but only out of the corner of her eye.
Holly always faces directly forward when she's driving. Those movie sequences where the driver looks at his passenger for seconds at a time while delivering dialogue drive her absolutely crazy. She always wants to shout, "Look at the road, dummy! Do you want to hit a kid while you're discussing your love life?"
What do you think, Holly? She considers this carefully. I think you should show your parents as much as you showed the agent, she says at last. Listen to what they say. Get a read on their feelings and respect them. Then push ahead. Write it all down. The good, the bad, and the ugly.
They've come to the Covington exit. Holly puts on her blinker.
I've never written a book, so I can't say for sure. But I think it takes a certain amount of bravery. So that's what you should do, I think. Be brave.
And that's what I need to be now, she thinks. Home is only 2 miles away, and home is where the heartache is.
4. The Gibney house is in a development called Meadowbrook Estates. As Holly weaves her way through the spider web of streets to the home of the spider, she thinks, and is immediately ashamed of thinking about her mother that way. Jerome says, "If I lived here and came home drunk, I'd probably spend at least an hour finding the right house." He's right. They're New England salt boxes, only set apart from one another by different colors, which wouldn't be much help at night, even with the streetlights. There are probably different flower beds in the warm months, but now the yards of Meadowbrook Estates are covered in crusty scarves of old snow. Holly could tell Jerome that her mother likes the sameness. It makes her feel safe. Charlotte Gibney has her own issues, but doesn't. She's gearing up for what promises to be a stressful lunch and an even more stressful afternoon. Moving day, she thinks. Oh, God. She pulls into the driveway of 42 Lily Court, kills the engine, and turns to Jerome. "You need to be prepared. Mother says he's gotten a lot worse in the last few weeks. Sometimes she exaggerates, but I don't think she is this time." "I understand the situation." He gives one of her hands a brief squeeze. "I'll be fine. You just take care of yourself, okay?" Before she can reply, the door of number 42 opens and Charlotte Gibney comes out, still in her good church clothes. Holly raises one hand in a tentative hello gesture, which Charlotte doesn't return. "Come inside," she says. "You're late." Holly knows she's late by 5 minutes. As they approach the door, Charlotte gives Jerome a what's-he-doing-here look. "You know Jerome," Holly says. "It's true they've met half a dozen times, and Charlotte always favors him with that same look. He came to keep me company and lend moral support." Jerome gives Charlotte his most charming smile. "Hello, Mrs. Gibney. I invited myself along. Hope you don't mind." To this, Charlotte simply says, "Come in. I'm freezing out here." As though it had been their idea for her to come out on the stoop rather than her own. Number 42, where Charlotte has lived with her brother since her husband died, is overheated and smelling so strongly of potpourri that Holly hopes she won't begin coughing, or gagging, which would be even worse. There are 4 side tables in the little hall, narrowing the passage to the living room enough to make the trip perilous, especially since each table is crammed with the little china figurines that are Charlotte's passion. Elves, gnomes, trolls, angels, clowns, bunnies, ballerinas, doggies, kitties, snowmen, Jack and Jill with a bucket each, and the pièce de la résistance, a Pillsbury doughboy. "Lunch is on the table," Charlotte says. "Just fruit cup and cold chicken, I'm afraid. But there's cake for dessert and... Her eyes fill with tears, and when Holly sees them, she feels, in spite of all the work she's done in therapy, a surge of resentment that's close to hate. Maybe it is hate. She thinks of all the time she cried in her mother's presence and was told to go to her room until you get that out of your system. She feels an urge to throw those very words in her mother's face now, but gives Charlotte an awkward hug instead. As she does, she feels how close the bones lie under that thin and flabby flesh, and realizes her mother is old. How can she dislike an old woman who so obviously needs her help? The answer seems to be quite easily. After a moment, Charlotte pushes Holly away with a little grimace as though she smelled something bad. "Go see your uncle and tell him lunch is ready. You know where he is." Indeed, Holly does. From the living room comes the sound of professionally excited announcers doing a football pregame show. She and Jerome go single file so as not to risk upsetting any members of the China Gallery.
"How many of these does she have?" Jerome murmurs.
Holly shakes her head. "I don't know. She always liked them, but it's gotten out of hand since my father died." Then lifting her voice and making it artificially bright, "Hi, Uncle Henry. All ready for lunch?" Uncle Henry clearly didn't make the run to church. He slumped in his lazy boy, wearing a Purdue sweatshirt with some of his breakfast egg on it, and a pair of jeans, the kind with the elasticized waist. They are riding low, showing a pair of boxer shorts with tiny blue pennants on them. He looks from the TV to his visitors. For a moment he's totally blank, then he smiles.
Janie, what are you doing here?
That goes through Holly like a glass dagger, and her mind flashes momentarily to Chet Andowski with his scratched hands and torn suit coat pocket. And why would it not? Janie was her cousin, bright and vivacious, all the things Holly could never be, and she was Bill Hodges' girlfriend for a while, before she died in another explosion, victim of a bomb planted by Brady Hartsfield and meant for Bill himself.
It's not Janie, Uncle Henry,
still with that artificial brightness, the kind usually saved for cocktail parties.
It's Holly.
There's another of those blank pauses as Rusty relays go about business they used to do lickety-split. Then he nods.
Sure. It's my eyes, I guess. From looking at the TV too long.
His eyes, Holly thinks, are hardly the point. Janie is years in her grave. That's the point.
Come here, girl, and give me a hug.
She does so, as briefly as possible. When she pulls back, he's staring at Jerome.
Who's this?
For a terrible moment, she thinks he's going to finish by saying, this black boy, or maybe even this jigaboo, but he doesn't.
This guy. I thought you were seeing that cop.
This time she doesn't bother to correct him about who she is. It's Jerome. Jerome Robinson. You've met him before.
Have I? Mind must be going.
He says it not even as a joke, just as a kind of conversational placeholder without realizing that's exactly the case. Jerome shakes his hand. How you doing, sir?
Not bad for an old fella,
Uncle Henry says, and before he can say more, Charlotte calls, practically shrieks from the kitchen that lunch is on.
His master's voice, Henry says good-humoredly, and when he stands up, his pants fall down.
He doesn't seem to realize. Jerome gives Holly a tiny jerk of the head toward the kitchen. She gives him a doubtful look in return, but goes. Let me just help you with those, Jerome says. Uncle Henry doesn't reply, but only stares at the TV with his hands dangling at his sides while Jerome pulls up his pants. There you go. Ready to eat? Uncle Henry looks at Jerome startled, as if just registering his presence, which is probably true.
I don't know about you, son, he says.
Don't know what about me, sir? Jerome asks, taking Uncle Henry by the shoulder and getting him turned toward the kitchen.
The cop was too old for Janie, but you look too young.
He shakes his head. I just don't know. 5. They get through lunch with Charlotte scolding Uncle Henry along and sometimes helping him with his food. Twice she leaves the table and comes back wiping her eyes. Through analysis and therapy, Holly has come to realize that her mother is almost as terrified of life as Holly herself used to be, and that her most unpleasant characteristics, her need to criticize, her need to control situations, arise from that fear. Here is a situation she can't control.
And she loves him, Holly thinks. That too. He's her brother. She loves him. And now he's leaving, in more ways than one.
When lunch is finished, Charlotte banishes the men to the living room.
Watch your game, boys, she tells them while she and Holly do up the few dishes.
As soon as they are alone, Charlotte tells Holly to have her friend move her car so they can get Henry's out of the garage. His things are in the trunk, all packed and ready to go. She's speaking out of the corner of her mouth like an actress in a bad spy movie.
He thinks I'm Janie, Holly says.
Of course he does. Janie was always his favorite, Charlotte says, and Holly feels another of those glass daggers go in. 6. Charlotte Gibney might not have been pleased to see Holly's friend turn up with her daughter, but she's more than willing to allow Jerome to pilot Uncle Henry's big old boat of a Buick, 125,000 miles on the clock, to the Rolling Hills Elder Care Center, where a room has been waiting since the 1st of December. Charlotte was hoping her brother could remain at home through Christmas, but now he's begun to wet the bed, which is bad, and to wander the neighborhood, sometimes in his bedroom slippers, which is worse. When they arrive, Holly doesn't see a single rolling hill in the vicinity, just a Wawa store and a decrepit bowling alley across the street. A man and a woman in blue care center jackets are leading a line of 6 or 8 golden oldies back from the bowling alley, the man holding up his hands to stop traffic until the group is safely across. The inmates, not the right word, but it's the one that occurs to her, are holding hands, making them look like prematurely aged children on a field trip.
"Is this the movies?"
Uncle Henry asks as Jerome wheels the Buick into the turnaround in front of the care center entrance.
"I thought we were going to the movies."
He's riding shotgun. At the house, he actually tried to get in behind the wheel until Charlotte and Holly got him turned around. No more driving for Uncle Henry. Charlotte filched her brother's driver's license from his wallet in June during one of Henry's increasingly long naps, then sat at the kitchen table and cried over it. "I'm sure they'll have movies here," Charlotte says. She's smiling and biting her lip as she does it. They are met in a lobby by a Mrs. Braddock, who treats Uncle Henry like an old friend, grasping both of his hands and telling him how glad she is to have you with us.
"With us for what?" Henry asks, looking around. "I have to go to work soon. The paperwork is all messed up. That helmet is worse than useless."
"Do you have his things?" Mrs. Braddock asks Charlotte. "Yes," Charlotte says, still smiling and biting her lip. Soon she may be crying. Holly knows the signs. "I'll get his suitcases," Jerome says quietly, but there's nothing wrong with Uncle Henry's ears.
"What suitcases? What suitcases?"
"We have a very nice room for you, Mr. Tibbs," Mrs. Braddock says. "Plenty of sunshine."
"They call me Mr. Tibbs," Uncle Henry bellows in a very credible Sidney Poitier imitation that makes the young woman at the desk and a passing orderly look around startled. Uncle Henry laughs and turns to his niece. "How many times did we watch that movie, Holly? 6 This time he got her name right, which makes her feel even worse.
"More," Holly says, and knows she may soon cry herself. She and her uncle watched a lot of movies together. Janie may have been his favorite, but Holly was his movie buddy, the two of them sitting on the couch with a bowl of popcorn between them.
"Yes," Uncle Henry says. "Yes, indeed."
But he's losing it again.
"Where are we? Where are we, really?"
"The place where you're probably going to die," Holly thinks, "unless they take you to the hospital to do it." Outside, she sees Jerome unloading a couple of tartan suitcases, also a suit bag. Will her uncle ever wear a suit again? Yes, probably. But only once. "Let's look at your room," Mrs. Braddock says. "You're going to like it, Henry." She takes his arm, but Henry resists. He looks at his sister. "What's going on here, Charlie?" "Don't cry now," Holly thinks. "Hold it in. Don't you dare. But oh, poop, here come the waterworks and in full flow."
"Why are you crying, Charlie?"
Then,
"I don't want to be here."
It's not his stentorian Mr. Tibbs bellow, more of a whine, like a kid realizing he's about to get a shot. He turns from Charlotte's tears to see Jerome coming in with his luggage.
"Here! Here! What are you doing with those traps? They're mine!"
"Well," Jerome says, but doesn't seem to know how to go on. The oldies are filing in from their trip to the bowling alley where Holly is sure a great many gutter balls were rolled. The employee who raised his hands to stop traffic joins a nurse who seems to have appeared from nowhere. She is broad of beam and thick of bicep. These two close in on Henry and take him gently by the arms.
"Let's go this way," says the bowling alley guy. "Have a look at the new crib, brother. See what you think."
"Think of what?"
Henry asks, but he begins to walk.
"You know something," the nurse says. "The game's on in the common room, and we've got the biggest TV you've ever seen. You'll feel like you're on a 50-yard line. We'll take a quick gander at your room, and then you can watch it."
"Plenty of cookies, too," Mrs. Braddock says. "Fresh baked."
"Is it the Browns?"
Henry asks. They are approaching double doors. He will soon disappear behind them. Where, Holly thinks, he'll begin living the dimmed-out remainder of his life. The nurse laughs.
"No, no, not the Browns. They're out of it. The Ravens. Peck 'em and deck 'em."
Good, Henry says, then adds something he never on God's earth would have said before his neural relays began to rust out. Those Browns are all a bunch of cunts.
Then he is gone. Mrs. Braddock reaches into the pocket of her dress and hands Charlotte a tissue. It's perfectly natural for them to be upset on moving-in day. He'll settle down. I have some more paperwork for you if you feel up to it, Mrs. Gibney. Charlotte nods. Over the sodden bouquet of the tissue, her eyes are red and streaming. This is the woman who scolded me for crying in public, Holly marvels. The one who told me to stop trying to be the center of attention. This is payback, and I could have done without it. Another orderly, the woods are full of them, Holly thinks, has materialized and is loading Uncle Henry's faded tartan bags and his Brooks Brothers suitor onto a trolley as if this place were just another Holiday Inn or Motel 6. Holly is staring at this and holding back her own tears when Jerome takes her gently by the arm and leads her outside. They sit on a bench in the cold. I want a cigarette, Holly says. First time in a long while. Pretend, he says, and exhales a plume of frosty air. She inhales and blows out her own cloud of vapor. She pretends.
7.
They don't stay overnight, although Charlotte assures them there's plenty of room. Holly doesn't like to think of her mother spending this first night alone, but she can't bear to stay. It isn't the house where Holly grew up, but the woman who lives here is the woman she grew up with. Holly is very different from the pale, chain-smoking, poetry-writing, bad poetry, girl who grew up in Charlotte Gibney's shadow. But that's hard to remember in her presence, because her mother still sees her as the damaged child who went everywhere with her shoulders hunched and her eyes cast down. It's Holly driving the first leg this time, and Jerome does the rest. It's long after dark when they see the lights of the city. Holly has been dozing in and out, thinking in a disconnected way about how Uncle Henry mistook her for Janie, the woman who was blown up in Bill Hodges' car. That leads her wandering mind back to the explosion at MacCready Middle School, and the correspondent with the torn pocket and the brick dust on his hands. She remembers thinking that there was something different about him that night. Well, sure, she thinks as she drifts toward another doze. In between the first bulletin that afternoon and the special report that night, Ondowski helps search the rubble, thus transitioning from reporting the story to becoming a part of it. That would change anybody. Suddenly her eyes snap open, and she sits bolt upright, startling Jerome.
What? Are you all right?
The mole! He doesn't know what she's talking about, and Holly doesn't care. It probably doesn't mean anything anyway, but she knows Bill Hodges would have congratulated her on her observation and on her memory, the thing Uncle Henry is now losing. Chet Ondowski, she said, the news correspondent who was first on the scene after the school blew up. In the afternoon, he had a mole beside his mouth, but when the special report came on that night at 10, it was gone.
Thank God for Max Factor, huh? Jerome says as he leaves the expressway.
He's right, of course. It even occurred to her when the news bulletin came on. Crooked tie, no time to cover the mole with makeup. Later on, when Ondowski's support crew arrived, they took care of that. Still, it's a little strange. Holly is sure a makeup person would have left the scratches. They were good TV, made the correspondent look heroic. But wouldn't the makeup guy or gal have cleaned some of the brick dust from around Ondowski's mouth in the process of covering the mole?
Holly, Jerome asks, are you over cranking again?
Yes, she says. Too much stress. Not enough rest.
Let it go.
Yes, she says. It's good advice. She intends to follow it.